WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Halberstam started his career in the 50s. In his new book, The 50s, he re-examines the decade and finds it was much more interesting than it appeared on the surface. The decade remembered for conformity actually sowed the seeds for the social and political upheaval of the 60s and 70s. Halberstam is also the author of The Best and the Brightest, The Powers That Be, and The Reckoning. He covered the early war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He spent the second half of the 50s covering the civil rights movement for Southern newspapers. I asked him why he wanted to write about the 50s.
Well, I wanted to write about it for a number of reasons. First, I had done The Reckoning, which is a book about America at a moment of jeopardy, you know, the Japanese beginning to challenge us industrially and economically. So I wanted to go back to a moment when we had been supreme, a time of real American economic hegemony, which was in the 1950s when everything, when God was in his heaven and the economic order was blessed and everybody's income went up 10% a year and inflation was low and everybody was spending more all the time. Part of that, I think, is also that I'm in some ways a child of the 50s. I graduated from high school in 1951 and from college in 1955. And many of these experiences, particularly the early civil rights days, because I was a reporter in Mississippi and Tennessee, were part of my life. And so, you know, I don't think journalistic autobiography is really very good. I mean, journalists spend 30, 35 years being reporters, and then someone with a book contract comes to them and says, we'd like you to write a book about your life. And the truth is, they don't really remember anything that happened. I mean, they sort of remember filing their dispatches from the PTT in Saigon or Leopoldville or Zaire, you know, or they say, you know, when I got to Paris to represent the New York Times, I felt that I got on quite well with the General de Gaulle. While we were not exactly intimate, he would often say after press conference, Monsieur Halberstam, your question was beautifully phrased today. Your French is getting better. Well, you know, so this in a way is like, is my way of doing my autobiography, but except in an exterior way. This is the world that I was part of and in some way helped form me.
Did you go back and you refer in the beginning of the book to pictures from the 50s that you were looking at and how formal they seemed, all the men in their suits, everything seemed to be in place, all the teenagers looking rather square.
And prim.
And prim, yeah.
The women are pert and the young men are sort of four square and reliable. They have a would-be Tab Hunter look to them.
Yeah, if they were lucky, they'd be Tab Hunter.
Well, I may be not so lucky if they were Tab
right.
Hunter, too.
So did you go back and look at pictures of yourself also?
Well, I've led such a vagabond life that there are very few pictures of me in the 50s. You know, I've lived in great disorder. Those years were years first in Mississippi and Tennessee, and then immediately I was overseas. So an awful lot of stuff that I should have in my possession, I don't. But there is a very famous photograph taken, not famous to the world, but famous to me and my colleagues, taken in 1954 on the Harvard Crimson. Three or four of us are sitting there, we're the editors, and we're sitting with Adlai Ewing Stevenson of Illinois, who was then the most beloved of liberal Democrats, and we're sitting there, and there I am. My hair is very short and very black, a great deal blacker than it is now. My face is sort of square and kind of a can-do American face, and I'm wearing the requisite tweed jacket and gray flannel slacks, and dear God, my wife really loves this photo because it shows how much she's improved me in recent years. White socks. There it is, the man with the white socks. So there are not a lot of photos existent, but there are a lot of photos in my mind of me in the 50s, of the simpler time and of my own ambition to be a reporter in the civil rights movement and of America in change.
What, you went to Harvard in
yes.
the 1950s.
What 1951. I entered 1951.
What did you see for yourself when you looked ahead? Did you see yourself as being, you know, a leader of tomorrow?
No. I came from a sort of middle-class background. We never had any money, but because my father had served in the war in World War. The Depression in World War II had cut us out of money, and we never had money, but we had we were middle class. There was never any doubt that my brother and I were going to go to college, and we were supposed to therefore trying, in the tradition of the children of Jewish immigrants, to go to the best. And by some mistake, we both got into Harvard from public high schools. And I never saw myself as a leader of men. What I wanted to do very badly, very early on, was to be a journalist. I thought that was what I wanted. I wanted to see if I could do it and do it well. And if I could do that, I wanted to be in on the action. I wanted to be a part of events. My heroes were men like Hodding Carter, who was the great Mississippi journalist who fought the Klan, and John Gunther, the wonderful globe-trotting journalist, and Theodore White, who was already writing wonderful books, and Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times, who was, when I was a sophomore in college, writing from Moscow for the New York Times. And I mean, it's interesting because there was a recent review of one of my books in the Boston Globe, and it referred to me as this generation's Theodore White and John Gunther. And I thought, what a wonderful thing. I have become in the same lineal collection as my heroes. And then there's a new book by Harrison Salisbury, who is vibrant in his 80s, and he lists some of his heroes, and he's done a chapter on me. So it's been very nice. I'm like the kid who wanted to play center field for the New York Yankees when he was a little boy and ended up growing up and doing it.
My guest is David Halberstam. He's written a new book about the 50s called The 50s. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist David Halberstam is my guest. Now, the 50s was the decade that there was the first teenage generation that knew what it meant to be a teenager. In other words, teenagers had their own lifestyle. Teenagers became their own market. Yeah,
the coming of the youth culture. Yeah,
exactly. Now, were you a part of that? Or?
Oh, God, no. No, I'm really I'm an interesting person in the sense that my mores are set in the 50s. I'm a 50s person. And by that, I mean growing up. The dates that are important in my life, 11 years old, 7 years old at the time of Pearl Harbor. I mean, I find stunning that we have a president today that cannot say where he was on the occasion, on the moment of Pearl Harbor. 11 years old at the end of World War II. So, I mean, I knew the Depression. I knew World War II. I had all the cautiousness of that part of the 50s. And then because of my own odd professional choices, being part of the early civil rights movement, I mean, covering the early civil rights movement, and then also covering Vietnam very early on and being one of the earliest pessimists, I have the odd contradiction of having a lot of the things that flowered in the 60s in me, but being a square from the 50s. I'm a square who got caught up in the most primal issues of the 60s. So I have a foot in both camps. I mean, my values in many ways are very old-fashioned and conservative, but my political allegiances are profoundly affected by the shattering duality of those events, civil rights change in Vietnam.
Well, you write about the coming of rock and roll in the book. Did that have any impact on you?
Well, see, sort of less. I think when you're that, I was about 21 when I was in West Point, Mississippi, which is 50 miles north of Tupelo, and I was at Partlow's drive-in one night, and someone said about this guy singing Hound Dog or Heartbreak Hotel. Is he one of them there at Tupelo Presley's? I mean, I used to watch Elvis's, Chet Atkins, the great guitar player, used to run the RCA studios in Nashville, and Chet was a pal. I'd go hear him play in Printer's Alley, and he would let me sneak in, and Elvis, who was exactly my age, it would come in, and I'd be hidden away watching these great secret sessions. But I was never as profoundly affected by rock. I think maybe, I was 21 when it happened, which means my music of choice and which fashioned me is when I was a boy in my parents' home. So it's really much more likely to be Sinatra and music of that generation. But Elvis is a critical figure. He's the first great coming of the youth culture. There is, I think, one of the most, we think that politics is only politics. We think that, you want a political moment in the 50s, here's one. Adlai Stevenson runs against Dwight Eisenhower for the second time. I don't think that's nearly as important a moment as the moment when Elvis Presley goes on the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, let's go back to this. Here's Elvis, the first figure of the youth culture. Not only that, he's a first figure who is blending the white and white American music with black American music, a white face on black music. And he's And he's Sam Phillips down in Memphis at Sun Records has always been looking for somebody like this. The night that the DJ there plays his music for the first time, the switchboard lights up. I mean, it's not hyped, it's not promoted, it is just visceral. And when they bring him in for an interview, they go find him in a movie theater. He hasn't got a phone. They have to call the neighbor's phone. They bring him in, and they say, I'm going to interview you, so don't say nothing dirty. So, and at the end of the interview, he says, when are you going to interview me? He said, son, I just did. Anyway, they say, they make very clear that he goes to Humes High. And the reason is that's because that is a white high school. They want to make clear that this is not a young black man. Well, he has this great success, and it's visceral. It's the youth culture. The kids have money, and they have money to spend on their own money, and they have their own record players. They're not dependent. You know, their moms and dads can't say, turn off that record player. That belongs to us. This is our living room. Then go to their rooms with their own little $45, $25 record players.
So are you telling us that you actually were at recording sessions with Elvis Presley in the 50s?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was the one reporter allowed to be, for example, Colonel Parker, when Elvis came back from the Army, Colonel Parker allowed me to be the one reporter to travel with him on his train ride back from Fort Dix to Memphis. And he's my age. He was a very sweet young man in those days. Anyway, the great moment, this is two really important political moments in the 50s. One is Brown versus Board of Education.
Wait, I have to stop you a second.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We'll get back to this.
Okay.
So yeah. What did you talk to Elvis about on the train?
Well, you know, I said, you know, how does it feel? I mean, there are these girls squealing at every stop. He says, I don't know. You know, I said, you know, why do you think it happens? He said, Mister, I don't know why it happens, but it's happening. I'll do the best I can with it. He was this very shy, quite modest country boy, not unlike a lot of others. There was this fluke thing that had happened. He didn't quite understand, but he was going to do the best he could with it. He called everybody, sir. He called me, sir. I was his own age. I looked at him and I said, hey, is that a suntan? He said, hell no, that's a wintan from being a tanker in Germany.
How'd you like being called, sir?
Well, it was about the first time, other than a few years, 20 years later, when you called me, sir, it really hasn't happened very often.
I think that's maybe a Southern thing.
But I found him very sweet, and I thought incredibly unpretentious. I mean, there was no arrogance. Now, there have been secret arrogance behind the calling of everybody sir or man, but he seemed to me about the least rebellious young man I'd ever met. Anyway, this is, I think, two critical political moments. One is Brown versus Board of Education, which I think forever changes America racially, culturally, in every moral. I mean, you know, who are the most beloved athletes of today? It's not Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. It's people like, you know, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson. People, I mean, they are the heroes. I mean, this country has changed forever by that decision. The second one is, I think, the moment when Elvis goes and sings on Ed Sullivan's show. Ed Sullivan is, in any real reason, in those days, the true American minister of culture. He decides what's going to go on his show, what's mainstream American and what is not. He's not just only a variety entrepreneur. He's a censor in any real sense. And he says very publicly, I am not going to have this young man, Elvis Presley, on my show because what he does is dirty. And so Elvis goes on Steve Allen's rival show on Sunday night. Steve Allen has never beaten Ed Sullivan before in the ratings. Elvis goes on, and for the first time in history, Steve Allen wins. And with that, Ed Sullivan quickly folds his tent, surrenders, sends Colonel Parker a telegram booking Elvis for three shows at $50,000. Elvis comes on, and that is the end of the old order. The old order, which would like to keep Elvis off, can't because of the commercial power of the new youth demographics. And Ed Sullivan quickly goes on and says, I want to say this about Elvis. This young man is the finest young man. We've never had a better experience with a young man. And of course, they shoot him, by the way, from the waist up. But that is as dramatic a moment in American culture. That's a very important political benchmark.
You were one of the first reporters to challenge the government when you were reporting on Vietnam. Yeah. In the decade before, the 50s, the decade that you write about, you were covering the civil rights movement. And you were seeing probably a lot of authorities who were masking the truth. Were the roots of your skepticism about the official truth, were those roots for you in the 50s?
Yes, I think covering the civil rights movement was a great place to go and start taking skeptical pills. I mean, you'd go into a town and the mayor would say, hey, you know, our colored folks, they're all happy here. They like it. My maid just told my wife today, you know, that those people there with Martin King, that they're all troublemakers, troublemakers from the North, the communists. They would say, and they'd say the NAACP, except they'd always deliberately mispronounce it and say the NACCP. They'd always deliberately, you know, and they'd say that Martin Luther, and then, you know, they'd make some pejorative reference to King. I mean, very early on in the South, since the entire matrix of established authority, mayor, governor, by and large senator, judges, were all so totally lined up against the forces of integration and obeying the law of the land, that very early on, and they obviously were convinced that whatever movement there was to the indigenous civil rights movement in their own states and communities, therefore was not legitimate, and it was only orchestrated by what they thought was outsiders. And there I was with other reporters going around and talking to the local black people and knowing that they very much indeed wanted to have integration. They wanted the better things of American life. They wanted their children to go to better schools. They wanted to make more money. They wanted to enter this society as a full-fledged member, and that these were very strong, powerful, proud people. So that was there was a healthy, you know, amount of skepticism that you picked up then.
David Halberstam, his new book is called The 50s. This is Fresh Air.